Side 3, 2010, Odyssey 2, continuing on page 95. The first problem was to stop that spin, which made Discovery not only uncontrollable, but almost unapproachable. As he suited up in the airlock with Max Berlovsky, Curnow had a very rare sensation of incompetence, even inferiority. It was not his line of business. He had already explained gloomily, "I'm a space engineer, not a space monkey." But the job had to be done. He alone possessed the skills that could save Discovery from Io's grasp. Max and his colleagues, working with unfamiliar circuit diagrams and equipment, would take far too long. By the time they had restored power to the ship and mastered its controls, it would have plunged into the sulfurous fire pits below. "You're not scared, are you?" asked Max, when they were about to put on their helmets. "Not enough to make a mess in my suit. Otherwise, yes." Max chuckled. "I'd say that's about right for this job. But don't worry. I'll get you there in one piece with my... what do you call it?" "Broomstick, because witches are supposed to ride them." "Oh, yes. Have you ever used one?" "I tried once, but mine got away from me. Everyone else thought it was very funny." There are some professions which have evolved unique and characteristic tools. The longshoreman's hook, the potter's wheel, the bricklayer's trowel, the geologist's hammer. The men who had to spend much of their time on zero-gravity construction projects had developed the broomstick. It was very simple, a hollow tube just a meter long with a footpad at one end and a retaining loop at the other. At the touch of a button, it could telescope out to 5 or 6 times its normal length, and the internal shock-absorbing system allowed a skilled operator to perform the most amazing maneuvers. The footpad could also become a claw or hook if necessary. There were many other refinements, but that was the basic design. It looked deceptively easy to use. It wasn't. The airlock pumps finished recycling. The exit sign came on. The outer doors opened, and they drifted slowly into the void. Discovery was windmilling about 200 meters away, following them in orbit around Io, which filled half the sky. Jupiter was invisible, on the other side of the satellite. This was a matter of deliberate choice. They were using Io as a shield to protect them from the energies raging back and forth in the flux tube that linked the two worlds. Even so, the radiation level was dangerously high. They had less than 15 minutes before they must get back to shelter. Almost immediately, Curnow had a problem with his suit. "It fitted me when I left Earth," he complained, "but now I'm rattling around inside like a pea in a pod." "That's perfectly normal, Walter," said Surgeon Commander Rudenko, breaking into the radio circuit. "You lost 10 kilos in hibernation, which you could very well afford to miss. And you've already put 3 of them back." Before Curnow had time to think of a suitable retort, he found himself gently but firmly jerked away from Leonov. "Just relax, Walter," said Brailovsky. "Don't use your thrusters, even if you start tumbling. Let me do all the work." Curnow could see the faint puffs from the younger man's backpack as its tiny jets drove them toward Discovery. With each little cloud of vapor, there came a gentle tug on the tow line, and he would start moving toward Brailovsky. But he never caught up with him before the next puff came. He felt rather like a yo-yo, now making one of its periodic comebacks on Earth, bouncing up and down on its string. There was only one safe way to approach the derelict, and that was along the axis around which it was slowly revolving. Discovery's center of rotation was approximately amidships, near the main antenna complex, and Brailovsky was heading directly toward this area, with his anxious partner in tow. "How will he stop both of us in time?" Curnow asked himself. Discovery was now a huge, slender dumbbell, slowly flailing the entire sky ahead of them. Though it took several minutes to complete one revolution, the far ends were moving at an impressive speed. Curnow tried to ignore them and concentrated on the approaching and immobile center. "I'm aiming for that," said Brailovsky. "Don't try to help, and don't be surprised at anything that happens." "What does he mean by that?" Curnow asked himself, while preparing to be as unsurprised as possible. Everything happened in about 5 seconds. Brailovsky triggered his broomstick so that it telescoped out to its full length of 4 meters and made contact with the approaching ship. The broomstick started to collapse, its internal spring absorbing Brailovsky's considerable momentum. But it did not, as Curnow had fully expected, bring him to rest beside the antenna mount. it immediately expanded again, reversing the Russian's velocity so that he was, in effect, reflected away from Discovery just as rapidly as he had approached. He flashed past Curnow, heading out into space again, only a few centimeters away. The startled American just had time to glimpse a large grin before Brailovsky shot past him. A second later, there was a jerk on the line connecting them and a quick surge of deceleration as they shared momentum. Their opposing velocities had been neatly canceled. They were virtually at rest with respect to Discovery. Curnow had merely to reach out to the nearest handhold and drag them both in. "Have you ever tried Russian roulette?" he asked when he had got his breath back. "No. What is it?" "I must teach you sometime. It's almost as good as this, for curing boredom." "I hope you're not suggesting, Walter, that Max would do anything dangerous." Dr. Rudenko sounded as if she was genuinely shocked, and Curnow decided it was best not to answer. Sometimes the Russians did not understand his peculiar sense of humor. "You could have fooled me," he muttered under his breath, not loud enough for her to hear. Now that they were firmly attached to the hub of the windmilling ship, he was no longer conscious of its rotation, especially when he fixed his gaze upon the metal plates immediately before his eyes, the latter stretching away into the distance, running along the slender cylinder that was Discovery's main structure, was his next objective. The spherical command module at its far end seemed several light years away, though he knew perfectly well that the distance was only 50 meters. "I'll go first," said Brailovsky, reeling in the slack on the line, linking them together. "Remember, it's downhill all the way from here. But that's no problem. You can hold on with one hand. Even at the bottom, gravity's only about a tenth G. And that's, what do you say? Chicken shit." "I think you mean chicken feed. And if it's all the same to you, I'm going feet first. I never liked crawling down ladders the wrong way up, even in fractional gravity." It was essential, Curnow was very well aware, to keep up this gently bantering tone. Otherwise, he would be simply overwhelmed by the mystery and danger of the situation. There he was, almost a billion kilometers from home, about to enter the most famous derelict in the entire history of space exploration. A media reporter had once called Discovery the Marie Celeste of space, and that was not a bad analogy. But there was also much that made his situation unique. Even if he tried to ignore the nightmare moonscape filling half the sky, there was a constant reminder of its presence at hand. Every time he touched the rungs of the ladder, his glove dislodged a thin mist of sulfur dust. Brailovsky, of course, was quite correct. The rotational gravity caused by the ship's end-over-end tumbling was easily countered. As he grew used to it, Curnow even welcomed the sense of direction it gave him. And then, quite suddenly, they had reached the big discolored sphere of Discovery's control and life support module. Only a few meters away was an emergency hatch, the very one, Curnow realized, that Bowman had entered for his final confrontation with Hal. "Hope we can get in," muttered Brailovsky. "Pity to come all this way and find the door locked." He scraped away the sulfur obscuring the airlock status display panel. "Dead, of course. Shall I try the controls? Won't do any harm, but nothing will happen." "You're right. Well, here goes with manual." It was fascinating to watch the narrow hairline open in the curved wall and to note the little puff of vapor dispersing into space, carrying with it a scrap of paper. Was that some vital message? They would never know. It spun away, tumbling end over end without losing any of its initial spin as it disappeared against the stars. Brailovsky kept turning the manual control for what seemed a very long time before the dark, uninviting cave of the airlock was completely open. Curnow had hoped that the emergency lights, at least, might still be operating. No such luck. "You're boss now, Walter. Welcome to U.S. territory." It certainly did not look very welcoming as he clambered inside, flashing the beam of his helmet light around the interior. As far as Curnow could tell, everything was in good order. What else had he expected? He asked himself half angrily. Closing the door manually took even longer than opening it, but there was no alternative until the ship was powered up again. Just before the hatch was sealed, Curnow risked a glance at the insane panorama outside. A flickering blue lake had opened up near the equator. He was sure it had not been there a few hours earlier. Brilliant yellow flares, the characteristic color of glowing sodium, were dancing along its edges, and the whole of the nightland was veiled in the ghostly plasma discharge of one of Io's almost continuous auroras. It was the stuff of future nightmares. And as if that was not sufficient, there was one further touch worthy of a mad surrealist artist. Stabbing up into the black sky, apparently emerging directly from the fire pits of the burning moon, was an immense curving horn, such as a doomed bullfighter might have glimpsed in the final moment of truth. The crescent of Jupiter was rising to greet Discovery and Leonov as they swept toward it along their common orbit. Chapter 18. Salvage. The moment that the outer hatch had closed behind them, there had been a subtle reversal of roles. Kurnow was at home now, while Brailovsky was out of his element, feeling ill at ease in the labyrinth of pitch-black corridors and tunnels that was Discovery's interior. In theory, Max knew his way around the ship, but that knowledge was based only on a study of its design drawings. Kurnow, on the other hand, had spent months working in Discovery's still uncompleted identical twin. He could quite literally find his way around blindfolded. Progress was made difficult because this part of the ship was designed for zero-G. Now the uncontrolled spin provided an artificial gravity, which, slight though it was, always seemed to be in the most inconvenient direction. "First thing we've got to do," muttered Kurnow, after sliding several meters down a corridor before he could grab a handhold, "is to stop this damned spin. And we can't do that until we have power. I only hope that Dave Bowman safeguarded all systems before he abandoned ship." "Are you sure he did abandon the ship? He may have intended to come back." "You may be right. I don't suppose we'll ever know, if he even knew himself." They had now entered the pod bay, Discovery's space garage, which normally contained three of the spherical one-man modules used for activities outside the ship. Only pod number three remained. Number one had been lost in the mysterious accident that had killed Frank Poole, and number two was with Dave Bowman, wherever he might be. The pod bay also contained two spacesuits, looking uncomfortably like decapitated corpses as they hung helmetless in their racks. It needed very little effort of the imagination, and Brailovsky's was now working overtime, to fill them with a whole menagerie of sinister occupants. It was unfortunate, but not altogether surprising, that Kurnow's sometimes irresponsible sense of humor got the better of him at this very moment. "Max," he said in a tone of deadly seriousness, "whatever happens, please don't go chasing off after the ship's cat." For a few milliseconds, Brailovsky was thrown off guard. He almost answered, "I do wish you hadn't said that, Walter," but checked himself in time. That would have been too damning an admission of weakness. Instead, he replied, "I'd like to meet the idiot who put that movie in our library." Katerina probably did it to test everyone's psychological balance. "Anyway, you laughed your head off when we screened it last week." Brailovsky was silent. Kurnow's remark was perfectly true, but that had been back in the familiar warmth and light of Leonov among his friends, not in a pitch-black, freezing derelict haunted by ghosts. No matter how rational one was, it was all too easy to imagine some implacable alien beast prowling these corridors, seeking whom it might devour. "It's all your fault, Grandma. May the Siberian tundra lie lightly on your beloved bones. I wish you hadn't filled my mind with so many of those gruesome legends. If I close my eyes, I can still see the hut of the Baba Yaga standing in that forest clearing on its scrawny chicken legs." "Enough of this nonsense. I'm a brilliant young engineer faced with the biggest technical challenge of his life, and I mustn't let my American friend know that I'm sometimes a frightened little boy." The noises did not help. There were too many of them, though they were so faint that only an experienced astronaut would have detected them against the sounds of his own suit. But to Max Brailovsky, accustomed to working in an environment of utter silence, they were distinctly unnerving, even though he knew that the occasional cracklings and creakings were almost certainly caused by thermal expansion as the ship turned like a roast on a spit. Feeble though the sun was out here, there was still an appreciable temperature change between light and shade. Even his familiar spacesuit felt wrong, now that there was pressure outside as well as in. All the forces acting on its joints were subtly altered, and he could no longer judge his movements accurately. "I'm a beginner, starting my training all over again," he told himself angrily. "Time to break the mood by some decisive action. Walter, I'd like to test the atmosphere. Pressure's okay, temperature, it's 105 below zero. A nice bracing Russian winter." Anyway, the air in my suit will keep out the worst of the cold. Well, go ahead, but let me shine my light on your face so I can see if you start to turn blue. And keep talking. Brailovsky unsealed his visor and swung the faceplate upward. He flinched momentarily as icy fingers seemed to caress his cheeks, then took a cautious sniff, followed by a deeper breath. Chilly, but my lungs aren't freezing. There's a funny smell, though. Stale, rotten, as if something's... Oh, no! Looking suddenly pale, Brailovsky quickly snapped the faceplate shut. What's the trouble, Max? Kernow asked with sudden and now perfectly genuine anxiety. Brailovsky did not reply. He looked as if he was still trying to regain control of himself. Indeed, he seemed in real danger of that always horrible and sometimes fatal disaster, vomiting in a spacesuit. There was a long silence, then Kernow said reassuringly, I get it, but I'm sure you're wrong. We know that Poole was lost in space. Bowman reported that he ejected the others after they died in hibernation. And we can be sure that he did. There can't be anyone here. Besides, it's so cold. He almost added, like a morgue, but checked himself in time. But suppose, whispered Brailovsky, just suppose Bowman managed to get back to the ship and died here. There was an even longer silence before Kernow deliberately and slowly opened his own faceplate. He winced as the freezing air bit into his lungs, then wrinkled his nose in disgust. I see what you mean. But you're letting your imagination run away with you. I'll bet you 10-1 that smell comes from the galley. Probably some meat went bad before the ship froze up, and Bowman must have been too busy to be a good housekeeper. I've known bachelor apartments that smelled as bad as this. Maybe you're right. I hope you are. Of course I am. And even if I'm not, damn it, what difference does it make? We've got a job to do, Max. If Dave Bowman's still here, that's not our department. Is it, Katerina? There was no reply from the surgeon commander. They had gone too far inside the ship for radio to penetrate. They were indeed on their own, but Max's spirits were rapidly reviving. It was a privilege, he decided, to work with Walter. The American engineer sometimes appeared soft and easygoing, but he was totally competent, and when necessary, as hard as nails. Together they would bring Discovery back to life, and perhaps back to Earth. Chapter 19. Operation Windmill. When Discovery suddenly lit up like the proverbial Christmas tree, navigation and interior lights blazing from end to end, the cheer aboard Leonov might almost have been heard across the vacuum between the two ships. It turned into an ironic groan when the lights promptly went out again. Nothing else happened for half an hour. Then the observation windows of Discovery's flight deck began to glow with the soft crimson of the emergency lights. A few minutes later, Kernow and Brailovsky could be seen moving around inside, their figures blurred by the film of sulfur dust. Hello, Max. Walter. Can you hear us? Called Tanya Orlova. Both the figures waved instantly, but made no other reply. Obviously, they were too busy to engage in casual conversation. The watchers on Leonov had to wait patiently while various lights flashed on and off. One of the three pod bay doors slowly opened and quickly closed, and the main antenna slewed around a modest 10 degrees. Hello, Leonov, said Kernow at last. Sorry to keep you waiting, but we've been rather busy. Here's a quick assessment, judging from what we've seen so far. The ship's in much better shape than I feared. Hull's intact, leakage negligible, air pressure 85% nominal. Quite breathable, but we'll have to do a major recycling job because it stinks to high heaven. The best news is that the power systems are okay. Main reactors stable, batteries in good shape. Almost all the circuit breakers were open. They jumped or been thrown by Bowman before he left, so all vital equipment's been safeguarded. But it will be a very big job checking everything before we have full power again. How long will that take? At least for the essential systems, life support, propulsion. Hard to say, Skipper. How long before we crash? Minimum presence prediction is 10 days, but you know how that's changed up and down. Well, if we don't run into any major snags, we can haul Discovery up to a stable orbit away from this hellhole. Oh, I'd say inside a week. Anything you need? No, Max and I are doing fine. We're going into the carousel now to check the bearings. I want to get it running as soon as possible. Pardon me, Walter, but is that important? Gravity's convenient, but we've managed without any for quite a while. I'm not after gravity, though it will be useful to have some aboard. If we can get the carousel running again, it will mop up the ship's spin, stop it tumbling. Then we'll be able to couple our airlocks together and cut out EVAs. That will make work 100 times easier. Nice idea, Walter, but you're not going to mate my ship to that windmill. Suppose the bearings seize up and the carousel jams. That would tear us to pieces. Agreed. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. I'll report again as soon as I can. No one had much rest for the next 2 days. By the end of that time, Curnow and Brailovsky had practically fallen asleep in their suits, but had completed their survey of Discovery and found no unpleasant surprises. Both the Space Agency and the State Department were relieved by the preliminary report. It allowed them to claim, with some justification, that Discovery was not a derelict, but a temporarily decommissioned United States spacecraft. Now the task of reconditioning had to begin. Once power had been restored, the next problem was the air. Even the most thorough house-cleaning operations had failed to remove the stink. Curnow had been right in identifying its source as food spoiled when refrigeration had failed. He also claimed, with mock seriousness, that it was quite romantic. "I've only got to close my eyes," he asserted, "and I feel I'm back on an old-time whaling ship. Can you imagine what the Pequod must have smelled like?" It was unanimously agreed that, after a visit to Discovery, very little effort of the imagination was required. The problem was finally solved, or at least reduced to manageable proportions, by dumping the ship's atmosphere. Fortunately, there was still enough air in the reserve tanks to replace it. One piece of very welcome news was that 90% of the propellant needed for the return journey was still available. Choosing ammonia instead of hydrogen as working fluid for the plasma drive had paid off handsomely. The more efficient hydrogen would have boiled off into space years ago, despite the insulation of the tanks and the frigid temperature outside. But almost all the ammonia had remained safely liquefied, and there was enough to get the ship back to a safe orbit around the Earth, or at least around the Moon. Checking Discovery's propeller-like spin was perhaps the most critical step in getting the ship under control. Sasha Kovalev compared Curnow and Brailovsky to Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, and expressed the hope that their windmill-tilting expedition would end more successfully. Very cautiously, with many pauses for checking, power was fed to the carousel motors and the great drum was brought up to speed, reabsorbing the spin it had long ago imparted to the ship. Discovery executed a complex series of precessions until eventually its end-over-end tumble had almost vanished. The last traces of unwanted rotation were neutralized by the attitude control jets until the two ships were floating motionless side by side, the squat, stocky Leonov dwarfed by the long, slender Discovery. Transfer from one to the other was now safe and easy, but Captain Orlova still refused to permit a physical link-up. Everyone agreed with this decision, for Io was coming steadily closer. They might yet have to abandon the vessel they had worked so hard to save. The fact that they now knew the reason for Discovery's mysterious orbitable decay did not help in the least. Every time the ship passed between Jupiter and Io, it sliced through the invisible flux tube linking the two bodies, the electric river flowing from world to world. The resulting eddy currents induced in the ship were continually slowing it down, breaking it once every revolution. There was no way to predict the final moment of impact, for the current in the flux tube varied wildly according to Jupiter's own inscrutable laws. Sometimes there were dramatic surges of activity accompanied by spectacular electric and auroral storms around Io. Then the ships would lose altitude by many kilometers, at the same time becoming uncomfortably hot before their thermal control systems could readjust. This unexpected effect had scared and surprised everyone before the obvious explanation was realized. Any form of braking produces heat. Somewhere, the heavy currents induced in the hulls of Leonov and Discovery turned them briefly into low-powered electric furnaces. It was not surprising that some of Discovery's food supply had been ruined during the years the ship had been alternately cooked and cooled. The festering landscape of Io, looking more than ever like an illustration from a medical textbook, was only 500 kilometers away when Curnow risked activating the main drive, while Leonov stood off at a very respectful distance. There were no visible effects, none of the smoke and fire of the old-time chemical rockets, but the two ships drew slowly apart as Discovery gained speed. After a few hours of very gentle maneuvering, both ships had raised themselves 1,000 kilometers. Now there was time to relax briefly and to make plans for the next stage in the mission. "You've done a wonderful job, Walter," said Surgeon Commander Rudenko, putting her ample arm around the exhausted Kurnow's shoulders. "We're all proud of you." Very casually, she broke a small capsule under his nose. It was 24 hours before he woke up, annoyed and hungry. Chapter 20, Guillotine. "What is it?" asked Kurnow with mild distaste, hefting the little mechanism in his hand. "A guillotine for mice?" "Not a bad description, but I'm after bigger game." Floyd pointed to a flashing arrow on the display screen, which was now showing a complicated circuit diagram. "You see this line?" "Yes, the main power supply. So? This is the point where it enters HAL's central processing unit. I'd like you to install this gadget here, inside the cable trunking, where it can't be found without a deliberate search." "I see. A remote control so you can pull the plug on HAL whenever you want to." "Very neat. And a non-conducting blade, too, so there won't be any embarrassing shorts when it's triggered." "Who makes toys like this? The CIA?" "Never mind. The control's in my room, that little red calculator I always keep on my desk. Put in 9 9s, take the square root, and press INT. That's all. I'm not sure of its range. We'll have to test that. But as long as Leonov and Discovery are within a couple of kilometers of each other, there'll be no danger of HAL running amok again." "Who are you going to tell about this thing?" "Well, the only person I'm really hiding it from is Chandra." "I guessed as much. But the fewer who know, the less likely it is to be talked about. I'll tell Tanya that it exists, and if there's an emergency, you can show her how to operate it." "What kind of emergency?" "That's not a very bright question, Walter. If I knew, I wouldn't need the damn thing." "Guess you're right. When do you want me to install your patented HAL zapper?" "As soon as you can, preferably tonight, when Chandra's sleeping." "Are you kidding? I don't think he ever sleeps. He's like a mother nursing a sick baby." "Well, he's got to come back to Leonov to eat occasionally." "I've news for you. The last time he went across, he tied a little sack of rice to his suit that will keep him going for weeks." "Then we'll have to use one of Katerina's famous knockout drops. They did a pretty good job on you, didn't they?" Kurnow was joking about Chandra, at least Floyd assumed that he was, though one could never be quite sure. He was fond of making outrageous statements with a perfectly straight face. It had been some time before the Russians had fully realized that. Soon, in self-defense, they were prone to preemptive laughs, even when Kurnow was being perfectly serious. Kurnow's own laugh, mercifully, had much abated since Floyd had first heard it in the upward-bound shuttle. On that occasion, it had obviously been primed by alcohol. He had fully expected to cringe from it again at the end of orbit party, when Leonov had finally made rendezvous with Discovery. But even on that occasion, though Kurnow had drunk a good deal, he had remained as much under control as Captain Orlova herself. The one thing he did take seriously was his work. On the way up from Earth, he had been a passenger. Now, he was crew. Chapter 21, Resurrection. "We are," Floyd told himself, "about to awaken a sleeping giant. How will HAL react to our presence after all these years? What will he remember of the past? And will he be friendly or hostile?" As he floated just behind Dr. Chandra in the zero-gravity environment of Discovery's flight deck, Floyd's mind was seldom far from the cutoff switch installed and tested only a few hours earlier. The radio control was mere centimeters from his hand, and he felt somewhat foolish to have brought it with him. At this stage, HAL was still disconnected from all the ship's operational circuits. Even if he was reactivated, he would be a brain without limbs, though not without sense organs. He would be able to communicate, but not to act. As Kurnow had put it, "The worst he can do is swear at us." "I'm ready for the first test, Captain," said Chandra. "All the missing modules have been replaced, and I've run diagnostic programs on all circuits. Everything appears normal, at least on this level." Captain Orlova glanced at Floyd, who gave a nod. At Chandra's insistence, only the three of them were present for this critical first run, and it was quite obvious that even this small audience was unwelcome. Very well, Dr. Chandra. Ever conscious of protocol, the captain added quickly, Dr. Floyd has given his approval, and I have no objections myself. I should explain, said Chandra in a tone that clearly conveyed disapproval, that his voice recognition and speech synthesis centers have been damaged. We'll have to teach him to speak all over again. Luckily, he learns several billion times faster than a human being. The scientist's fingers danced over the keyboard as he typed out a dozen words, apparently at random, carefully pronouncing each one as it appeared on the screen. Like a distorted echo, the words came back from the speaker grill, lifeless, indeed mechanical, with no sense of any intelligence behind them. This isn't the old Hal, thought Floyd. It's no better than the primitive speaking toys that were such a novelty when I was a kid. Chandra pressed the repeat button, and the series of words sounded once again. Already there was a noticeable improvement, though no one could have mistaken the speaker for a human being. The words I gave him contain the basic English phonemes. About 10 iterations, and he'll be acceptable. But I don't have the equipment to do a really good job of therapy.
Therapy? Asked Floyd. You mean that he's, well, brain damaged?
No, snapped Chandra. The logic circuits are in perfect condition. Only the voice output may be defective, though it will improve steadily. So check everything against the visual display to avoid misinterpretations. And when you do speak, enunciate carefully.
Floyd gave Captain Orlova a wry smile and asked the obvious question. What about all the Russian accents around here?
I'm sure that won't be a problem with Captain Orlova and Dr. Kovalev, but with the others, well, we'll have to run individual tests. Anyone who can't pass will have to use the keyboard.
That's still looking a long way ahead. For the present, you're the only one who should attempt communication. Agreed, Captain?
Absolutely.
Only the briefest of nods revealed that Dr. Chandra had heard them.
His fingers continued to fly over the keyboard, and columns of words and symbols flashed across the display screen at such a rate that no human being could possibly assimilate them. Presumably, Chandra had an eidetic memory, for he appeared to recognize whole pages of information at a glance.
Floyd and Orlov were just about to leave the scientist to his arcane devotions when he suddenly acknowledged their presence again, holding up his hand in warning or anticipation, with an almost hesitant movement. In marked contrast with his previous swift actions, he slid back a locking bar and pressed a single isolated key. Instantly, with no perceptible pause, a voice came from the console, no longer in a mechanical parody of human speech. There was intelligence, consciousness, self-awareness here, though as yet only on a rudimentary level.
Good morning, Dr. Chandra.
This is Hal. I am ready for my first lesson.
There was a moment of shocked silence. Then, acting on the same impulse, the two observers left the deck. Heywood Floyd would never have believed it. Dr. Chandra was crying.
Part 4, LaGrange, Chapter 22, Big Brother.
What delightful news about the baby dolphin! I can just imagine how excited Chris was when the proud parents brought it into the house. You should have heard the ohs and ahs of my shipmates when they saw the videos of them swimming together and Chris riding on its back. They suggest we call it Sputnik, which means companion as well as satellite. Sorry, it's been quite a while since my last message, but the newscasts will have given you an idea of the huge job we've had to do. Even Captain Tanya's given up all pretense of a regular schedule. Each problem has to be fixed as it comes along by whoever is on the spot. We sleep when we can't stay awake any longer. I think we can all be proud of what we've done. Both ships are operational, and we've nearly finished our first round of tests on Hal. In a couple of days, we'll know if we can trust him to fly Discovery when we leave here to make our final rendezvous with Big Brother. I don't know who first gave it that name. The Russians, understandably, aren't keen on it, and they've waxed quite sarcastic about our official designation, TMA-2, pointing out to me several times that it's the best part of a billion kilometers from Tycho. Also that Bowman reported no magnetic anomaly and that the only resemblance to TMA-1 is the shape. When I asked them what name they preferred, they came up with Zagadka, which means enigma. It's certainly an excellent name, but everyone smiles when I try to pronounce it, so I'll stick to Big Brother.
Whatever you call the thing, it's only 10,000 kilometers away now, and the trip won't take more than a few hours. But that last lap has us all nervous, I don't mind telling you. We'd hoped that we might find some new information aboard Discovery. That's been our only disappointment, though we should have expected it. Hal, of course, was disconnected long before the encounter, and so has no memories of what happened. Bowman has taken all his secrets with him. There's nothing in the ship's log and automatic recording systems that we didn't already know. The only new item we discovered was purely personal, a message that Bowman had left for his mother. I wonder why he never sent it. Obviously, he did expect or hope to return to the ship after that last EVA. Of course, we've had it forwarded to Mrs. Bowman. She's in a nursing home somewhere in Florida, and her mental condition is poor, so it may not mean anything to her. Well, that's all the news this time. I can't tell you how much I miss you, and the blue skies and green seas of Earth. All the colors here are reds and oranges and yellows, often as beautiful as the most fantastic sunset. But after a while, one grows sick for the cool, pure rays at the other end of the spectrum. My love to you both. I'll call again just as soon as I can. Chapter 23, Rendezvous. Nikolai Tarnovsky, Leonov's control and cybernetics expert, was the only man aboard who could talk to Dr. Chandra on something like his own terms, although Hal's principal creator and mentor was reluctant to admit anyone into his full confidence. Sheer physical exhaustion had forced him to accept help. Russian and Indo-American had formed a temporary alliance, which functioned surprisingly well. Most of the credit for this went to the good-natured Nikolai, who was somehow able to sense when Chandra really needed him and when he preferred to be alone. The fact that Nikolai's English was much the worst on the ship was totally unimportant, since most of the time both men spoke a computerese wholly unintelligible to anyone else. After a week's slow and careful reintegration, all of Hal's routine supervisory functions were operating reliably. He was like a man who could walk, carry out simple orders, do unskilled jobs, and engage in low-level conversation. In human terms, he had an intelligence quotient of perhaps 50. Only the faintest outlines of his original personality had yet emerged. He was still sleepwalking. Nevertheless, in Chandra's expert opinion, he was now quite capable of flying Discovery from its close orbit around Io up to the rendezvous with Big Brother. The prospect of getting an extra 7,000 kilometers away from the burning hell beneath them was welcomed by everyone. Trivial though that distance was, in astronomical terms, it meant that the sky would no longer be dominated by a landscape that might have been imagined by Dante or Hieronymus Bosch. And although not even the most violent eruptions had blasted any material up to the ships, there was always the fear that Io might attempt to set a new record. As it was, visibility from Leonov's observation deck was steadily degraded by a thin film of sulfur, and sooner or later someone would have to go out and clean it off. Only Curnow and Chandra were aboard Discovery when Hal was given the first control of the ship. It was a very limited form of control. He was merely repeating the program that had been fed into his memory and monitoring its execution. And the human crew was monitoring him. If any malfunction occurred, they would take over immediately. The first burn lasted for 10 minutes. Then Hal reported that Discovery had entered the transfer orbit. As soon as Leonov's radar and optical tracking confirmed that, the other ship injected itself into the same trajectory. Two minor in-course corrections were made. Then 3 hours and 15 minutes later, both arrived uneventfully at the first Lagrange point, L1, 10,500 kilometers up on the invisible line connecting the centers of Io and Jupiter. Hal had behaved impeccably, and Chandra showed unmistakable traces of such purely human emotions as satisfaction and even joy. But by that time, everyone's thoughts were elsewhere. Big Brother, alias Zagadka, was only 100 kilometers away. Even from that distance, it already appeared larger than the moon as seen from Earth, and shockingly unnatural in its straight-edged geometrical perfection. Against the background of space, it would have been completely invisible, but the scudding Jovian clouds 350,000 kilometers below showed it up in dramatic relief. They also produced an illusion that, once experienced, the mind found almost impossible to refute, because there was no way in which its real location could be judged by the eye. Big Brother often looked like a yawning trapdoor set in the face of Jupiter. There was no reason to suppose that 100 kilometers would be safer than 10 or more dangerous than 1,000. It merely seemed psychologically right for a first reconnaissance. From that distance, the ship's telescopes could have revealed details only centimeters across, but there were none to be seen. Big Brother appeared completely featureless, which, for an object that had presumably survived millions of years of bombardment by space debris, was incredible. When Floyd stared through the binocular eyepiece, it seemed to him that he could reach out and touch those smooth ebon surfaces, just as he had done on the moon years ago. That first time, it had been with the gloved hand of his spacesuit. Not until the Tycho monolith had been enclosed in a pressurized dome had he been able to use his naked hand. That had made no difference. He did not feel that he had ever really touched TMA-1. The tips of his fingers had seemed to skitter over an invisible barrier, and the harder he pushed, the greater the repulsion grew. He wondered if Big Brother would produce the same effect. Yet before they came that close, they had to make every test they could devise and report their observations to Earth. They were in much the same position as explosives experts trying to defuse a new type of bomb, which might be detonated by the slightest false move. For all they could tell, even the most delicate of radar probes might trigger some unimaginable catastrophe. For the first 24 hours, they did nothing except observe with passive instruments, telescopes, cameras, sensors on every wavelength. Vasily Orlov also took the opportunity of measuring the slab's dimensions with the greatest possible precision and confirmed the famous 1:4:9 ratio to 6 decimal places. Big Brother was exactly the same shape as TMA-1, but it was more than 2 kilometers long. It was 718 times larger than its small sibling. And there was a second mathematical mystery. Men had been arguing for years over that 1:4:9 ratio, the squares of the first 3 integers. That could not possibly be a coincidence. Now here was another number to conjure with. Back on Earth, statisticians and mathematical physicists were soon playing happily with their computers, trying to relate the ratio to the fundamental constants of nature, the velocity of light, the proton-electron mass ratio, the fine structure constant. They were quickly joined by a gaggle of numerologists, astrologers, and mystics who threw in the height of the Great Pyramid, the diameter of Stonehenge, the azimuth bearings of the Nazca lines, the latitude of Easter Island, and a host of other factors from which they were able to draw the most amazing conclusions about the future. They were not in the least deterred when a celebrated Washington humorist claimed that his calculations proved that the world ended on December 31st, 1999, but that everyone had had too much of a hangover to notice. Nor did Big Brother appear to notice the 2 ships that had arrived in its vicinity, even when they cautiously probed it with radar beams and bombarded it with strings of radio pulses, which, it was hoped, would encourage any intelligent listener to answer in the same fashion. After 2 frustrating days, with the approval of Mission Control, the ships halved their distance. From 50 kilometers, the largest face of the slab appeared, about 4 times the width of the moon in Earth's sky. Impressive, but not so large as to be psychologically overwhelming. It could not yet compete with Jupiter, 10 times larger still, and already the mood of the expedition was changing from awed alertness to a certain impatience. Walter Kernow spoke for almost everyone. Big Brother may be willing to wait a few million years. We'd like to get away a little sooner. Chapter 24, Reconnaissance. Discovery had left Earth with 3 of the little space pods that allowed an astronaut to perform extravehicular activities in shirt-sleeve comfort. One had been lost in the accident, if it was an accident, that had killed Frank Poole. Another had carried Dave Bowman to his final appointment with Big Brother and shared whatever fate befell him. A third was still in the ship's garage, the pod bay. It lacked one important component, the hatch blown off by Commander Bowman when he had made his hazardous vacuum crossing and entered the ship through the emergency airlock after Hal had refused to open the pod bay door. The resulting blast of air had rocketed the pod several 100 kilometers away before Bowman, busy with more important matters, had brought it back under radio control. It was not surprising that he had never bothered to replace the missing hatch. Now pod number 3, on which Max, refusing all explanations, had stenciled the name Nina, was being prepared for another EVA. It still lacked a hatch, but that was unimportant. No one would be riding inside. Bowman's devotion to duty was a piece of unexpected luck, and it would have been folly not to take advantage of it. By using Nina as a robot probe, Big Brother could be examined at close quarters without risking human lives. That at least was the theory. No one could rule out the possibility of a backlash that might engulf the ship. After all, 50 kilometers was not even a hair's breadth as cosmic distances went. After years of neglect, Nina looked distinctly shabby. The dust that was always floating around in zero-G had settled over the outer surface, so that the once immaculately white hull had become a dingy gray. As it slowly accelerated away from the ship, its external manipulators folded neatly back and its oval viewport staring spaceward like a huge dead eye, it did not seem a very impressive ambassador of mankind. But that was a distinct advantage. So humble an emissary might be tolerated, and its small size and low velocity should emphasize its peaceful intentions. There had been a suggestion that it should approach Big Brother with open hands. The idea was quickly turned down when almost everyone agreed that if they saw Nina heading toward them, mechanical claws outstretched, they would run for their lives. After a leisurely two-hour trip, Nina came to rest 100 meters from one corner of the huge rectangular slab. From so close at hand, there was no sense of its true shape. The TV cameras might have been looking down on the tip of a black tetrahedron of indefinite size. The onboard instruments showed no sign of radioactivity or magnetic fields. Nothing whatsoever was coming from Big Brother except the tiny fraction of sunlight it condescended to reflect. After 5 minutes' pause, the equivalent, it was intended, of "Hello, here I am," Nina started a diagonal crossing of the smaller face, then the next larger, and finally the largest, keeping at a distance of about 50 meters, but occasionally coming into five. Whatever the separation, Big Brother looked exactly the same, smooth and featureless. Long before the mission was completed, it had become boring, and the spectators on both ships had gone back to their various jobs, only glancing at the monitors from time to time. "That's it," said Walter Kernow at last, when Nina had arrived back where she had started. "We could spend the rest of our lives doing this without learning anything more. What do I do with Nina? Bring her home?" "No," said Vasily, breaking into the circuit from aboard Leonov. "I've a suggestion. Take her to the exact center of the big face. Bring her to rest, 100 meters away, and leave her parked there with the radar switched to maximum precision."
"No problem, except that there's bound to be some residual drift."
"But what's the point?" "I've just remembered an exercise from one of my college astronomy courses, the gravitational attraction of an infinite flat plate. I never thought I'd have a chance of using it in real life. After I've studied Nina's movements for a few hours, at least I'll be able to calculate Zagadka's mass. That is, if it has any. I'm beginning to think there's nothing really there."
"There's an easy way to settle that, and we'll have to do it eventually. Nina must go in and touch the thing."
"She already has."
"What do you mean?" asked Kernow, rather indignantly. "I never got nearer than 5 meters.
"I'm not criticizing your driving skills, though it was a pretty close thing at that first encounter, wasn't it? But you've been tapping gently on Zagadka every time you use Nina's thrusters near its surface."
"A flea jumping on an elephant."
"Perhaps. We simply don't know. But we'd better assume that, one way or another, it's aware of our presence, and will only tolerate us as long as we aren't a nuisance." He left the unspoken question hanging in the air. How did one annoy a 2-kilometer-long black rectangular slab, and just what form would its disapproval take?
Chapter 25. The View from LaGrange. Astronomy was full of such intriguing but meaningless coincidences. The most famous was the fact that from the Earth both Sun and Moon had the same apparent diameter. Here, at the L1 libration point, which Big Brother had chosen for its cosmic balancing act on the gravitational tightrope between Jupiter and Io, a similar phenomenon occurred. Planet and satellite appeared exactly the same size. And what a size! Not the miserable half-degree of Sun and Moon, but 40 times their diameter, 1,600 times their area. The sight of either was enough to fill the mind with awe and wonder. Together, the spectacle was overwhelming. Every 42 hours, they would go through their complete cycle of phases. When Io was new, Jupiter was full, and vice versa. But even when the Sun was hiding behind Jupiter and the planet presented only its night side, it was unmistakably there, a huge black disk eclipsing the stars.
Sometimes that blackness would be momentarily rent by lightning flashes lasting for many seconds from electrical storms far larger than the Earth. On the opposite side of the sky, always keeping the same face toward its giant master, Io would be a sluggishly boiling cauldron of reds and oranges, with occasional yellow clouds erupting from one of its volcanoes and falling swiftly back to the surface. Like Jupiter, but on a slightly longer time scale, Io was a world without geography. Its face was remodeled in a matter of decades, Jupiter's in a matter of days. As Io waned toward its last quarter, so the vast, intricately banded Jovian cloudscape would light up beneath the tiny distant sun. Sometimes the shadow of Io itself, or one of the outer satellites, would drift across the face of Jupiter, while every revolution would show the planet-sized vortex of the Great Red Spot, a hurricane that had endured for centuries, if not for millennia. Poised between such wonders, the crew of Leonov had material for lifetimes of research. But the natural objects of the Jovian system were at the very bottom of their list of priorities. Big Brother was number one, though the ships had now moved in to only 5 kilometers. Tanya still refused to allow any direct physical contact. "I'm going to wait," she said, "until we're in a position to make a quick getaway. We'll sit and watch until our launch window opens. Then we'll consider our next move." It was true that Nina had finally grounded on Big Brother after a leisurely 50-minute fall. This had allowed Vasily to calculate the object's mass as a surprisingly low 950,000 tons, which gave it about the density of air. Presumably it was hollow, which provoked endless speculation about what might be inside. But there were plenty of practical everyday problems to take their minds off these greater issues. Housekeeping chores aboard Leonov and Discovery absorbed 90% of their working time, though operations were much more efficient since the two ships had been coupled by a flexible docking connection. Kurnow had finally convinced Tanya that Discovery's carousel would not suddenly seize up and tear the ships to pieces, so it had become possible to move freely from one vessel to the other merely by opening and closing two sets of airtight doors. Spacesuits and time-consuming EVAs were no longer necessary, to the great delight of everyone except Max, who loved going outside and exercising with his broomstick. The two crew members quite unaffected by this were Chandra and Chernovsky, who now virtually lived aboard Discovery and worked around the clock, continuing their apparently endless dialogue with Hal. "When will you be ready?" they were asked, at least once a day. They refused to make any promises. Hal remained a low-grade moron. Then, a week after the rendezvous with Big Brother, Chandra unexpectedly announced, "We are ready." Only the two lady medics were absent from Discovery's flight deck, and that was merely because there was no room for them. They were watching on Leonov's monitors. Floyd stood immediately behind Chandra, his hand never far from what Kurnow, with his usual gift for the neat phrase, had called his pocket giant killer. "Let me emphasize again," said Chandra, "that there must be no talking. Your accents will confuse him. I can speak, but no one else. Is that understood?" Chandra looked and sounded at the edge of exhaustion, yet his voice held a note of authority that no one had ever heard before. Tanya might be the boss everywhere else, but he was master here. The audience, some anchored to convenient handholds, some floating freely, nodded assent. Chandra closed an audio switch and said quietly but clearly, "Good morning, Hal." An instant later, it seemed to Floyd that the years had rolled away. It was no longer a simple electronic toy that answered back. Hal had returned. "Good morning, Dr. Chandra. Do you feel capable of resuming your duties?" "Of course. I am completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly."
"Then do you mind if I ask you a few questions?"
"Not at all."
"Do you recall a failure of the AE-35 antenna control unit?"
"Certainly not." Despite Chandra's injunction, there was a little gasp from the listeners. This is like tiptoeing through a minefield, thought Floyd, as he patted the reassuring shape of the radio cutoff. If that line of questioning triggered another psychosis, he could kill Hal in a second. He knew, having rehearsed the procedure a dozen times. But a second was eons to a computer. That was a chance they would have to take.
"You do not remember either Dave Bowman or Frank Poole going out to replace the AE-35 unit?"
"No, that could not have happened, or I would have remembered it. Where are Frank and Dave? Who are these people? I can only identify you. though I compute a 65% probability that the man behind you is Dr. Haywood Floyd. Remembering Chandra's strict injunction, Floyd refrained from congratulating Hal. After a decade, 65% was a pretty good score. Many humans would not have done so well. Don't worry, Hal. I will explain everything later. Has the mission been completed? You know I have the greatest enthusiasm for it. The mission has been completed. You have carried out your program. Now, if you will excuse us, we wish to have a private conversation.
Certainly.
Chandra switched off sound and vision inputs to the main console. As far as this part of the ship was concerned, Hal was now deaf and blind.
Well, what was all that about? Demanded Vasily Orlov.
It means, said Chandra carefully and precisely, that I have erased all Hal's memories beginning at the moment when the trouble started.
That sounds quite a feat, marveled Sasha. How did you do it?
I am afraid it would take me longer to explain than it did to carry out the operation.
Chandra, I am a computer expert, though not in the same class as you and Nikolai. The 9000 series uses holographic memories, doesn't it? So you couldn't have used a simple chronological erasure. It must have been some kind of tapeworm homing on selected words and concepts.
Tapeworm, said Katerina over the ship's intercom. I thought that was my department, though I'm glad to say I've never seen one of the beastly things outside a jar of alcohol. What are you talking about?
Computer jargon, Katerina. In the old days, the very old days, they really did use magnetic tape, and it's possible to construct a program that can be fed into a system to hunt down and destroy, eat, if you like, any desired memories. Can't you do the same sort of thing to human beings by hypnosis?
Yes, but it can always be reversed. We never really forget anything. We only think we do.
A computer doesn't work that way. When it's told to forget something, it does. The information is completely erased.
So Hal has absolutely no memory of his misbehavior?
I cannot be 100% certain of that, answered Chandra. There may be some memories that were in transit from one address to another when the tapeworm was making its search. But this is very unlikely.
Fascinating, said Tanya, after everyone had thought this over in silence for some time. But the much more important question is, can he be relied upon in future? Before Chandra could answer, Floyd anticipated him.
The same set of circumstances can never arise again. I can promise you that. The whole trouble started because it's difficult to explain security to a computer.
Or to human beings, muttered Kurnow, not very sotto voce.
I hope you're right, said Tanya without much conviction.
What's the next step, Chandra?
Nothing so tricky, merely long and tedious. Now we have to program him to initiate the Jupiter escape sequence and to bring Discovery home, 3 years after we've got back on our high-speed orbit.
Chapter 26, Probation. 2. Victor Milson, Chairman, National Council on Astronautics, Washington. From Haywood Floyd aboard USSC Discovery. Subject, malfunction of onboard computer HAL 9000. Classification, secret. Dr. Chandra Shigaram Pillai, hereinafter referred to as Dr. C, has now completed his preliminary examination of HAL. He has restored all missing modules and the computer appears to be fully operational. Details of Dr. C's actions and conclusions will be found in the report he and Dr. Chernofsky will submit shortly. Meanwhile, you have asked me to summarize them in non-technical terms for the benefit of the Council, especially the new members who will not be familiar with the background. Frankly, I doubt my ability to do this. As you know, I am not a computer specialist, but I will do my best. The problem was apparently caused by a conflict between HAL's basic instructions and the requirements of security. By direct presidential order, the existence of TMA-1 was kept a complete secret. Only those with a need to know were permitted access to the information. Discovery's mission to Jupiter was already in the advanced planning stage when TMA-1 was excavated and radiated its signal to that planet. As the function of the prime crew, Bowman, Poole, was merely to get the vessel to its destination, it was decided that they should not be informed of its new objective. By training the investigative team, Kaminsky, Hunter, Whitehead, separately, and placing them in hibernation before the voyage began, it was felt that a much higher degree of security would be attained.
as the danger of leaks, accidental or otherwise, would be greatly reduced. I would like to remind you that at the time, my memorandum NCA 342/23/top secret of 010430, I pointed out several objections to this policy. However, they were overruled at a higher level. As Hal was capable of operating the ship without human assistance, it was also decided that he should be programmed to carry out the mission autonomously in the event of the crews being incapacitated or killed. He was therefore given full knowledge of its objectives, but was not permitted to reveal them to Bowman or Poole. This situation conflicted with the purpose for which Hal had been designed, the accurate processing of information without distortion or concealment. As a result, Hal developed what could be called, in human terms, a psychosis, specifically schizophrenia. Dr. C. informs me that in technical terminology, Hal became trapped in a Hofstadter-Mobius loop, a situation apparently not uncommon among advanced computers with autonomous goal-seeking programs. He suggests that for further information you contact Professor Hofstadter himself. To put it crudely, if I understand Dr. C., Hal was faced with an intolerable dilemma, and so developed paranoiac symptoms that were directed against those monitoring his performance back on Earth. He accordingly attempted to break the radio link with Mission Control, first by reporting a non-existent fault in the AE-35 antenna unit. This involved him not only in a direct lie, which must have aggravated his psychosis still further, but also in a confrontation with the crew. Presumably, we can only guess at this, of course, he decided that the only way out of the situation was to eliminate his human colleagues, which he very nearly succeeded in doing. Looking at the matter purely objectively, it would have been interesting to see what would have happened had he continued the mission alone, without man-made interference. This is virtually all I have been able to learn from Dr. C. I do not like to question him further, as he is working to the point of exhaustion. But even allowing for this fact, I must frankly state, and please keep this absolutely confidential, that Dr. C. is not always as cooperative as he should be. He adopts a defensive attitude toward Hal, which sometimes makes it extremely difficult to discuss the subject. Even Dr. Chernofsky, who might have been expected to be a little more independent, often appears to share this viewpoint. However, the only really important question is, can Hal be relied upon in the future? Dr. C., of course, has no doubts on the matter. He claims to have obliterated all the computer's memories of the traumatic events leading up to the disconnection, nor does he believe that Hal can suffer from anything remotely analogous to the human sense of guilt. In any case, it seems impossible that the situation that caused the original problem can ever arise again. Although Hal suffers from a number of peculiarities, they are not of a nature that would cause any apprehension. They are merely minor annoyances, some of them even amusing. And as you know, but Dr. C. does not, I have taken steps that will give us complete control as a last resort. To sum up, the rehabilitation of HAL 9000 is proceeding satisfactorily. One might even say that he is on probation. I wonder if he knows it. Chapter 27, Interlude, True Confessions. The human mind has an astonishing capacity to adapt. After a while, even the incredible becomes commonplace. There were times when the crew of Leonov switched off their surroundings, perhaps in an unconscious move to preserve sanity. Dr. Heywood Floyd often thought that on such occasions Walter Kernow worked a little too hard at being the life and soul of the party. Yet though he triggered what Sasha Kovalev later called the True Confessions episode, he certainly had not planned anything of the sort. It arose spontaneously when he voiced the universal dissatisfaction with almost all aspects of zero-gravity plumbing. "If I could have one wish granted," he exclaimed during the daily 6 o'clock Soviet, "it would be to soak in a nice foaming tub scented with essence of pine and with just my nose above the waterline." When the murmurs of assent and sighs of frustrated desire had died away, Katerina Rudenko took up the challenge. "How splendidly decadent, Walter," she beamed at him with cheerful disapproval. "It makes you sound like a Roman emperor. If I were back on Earth, I'd like something more active."
"Such as?"
Am I allowed to go back in time as well?"
"If you like."
"When I was a girl, I used to go for holidays to a collective farm in Georgia. there was a beautiful Palomino stallion, bought by the director out of the money he'd made on the local black market. He was an old scoundrel, but I loved him, and he used to let me gallop Alexander all over the countryside. I might have been killed, but that's the memory that brings Earth back to me more than anything else. There was a moment of thoughtful silence. Then Curnow asked,
"Any other volunteers?"
Everyone seemed so lost in their own memories that the game might have ended there, had not Maxim Belovsky started it off again.
"I'd like to be diving. That was just about my favorite hobby, when I had time for one, and I was glad I could keep it up through my cosmonaut training. I've dived off Pacific atolls, the Great Barrier Reef, the Red Sea. Coral reefs are the most beautiful places in the world. Yet the experience I remember best was in quite a different place, one of the Japanese kelp forests. It was like an underwater cathedral, with sunlight slanting through those enormous leaves. Mysterious, magical. I've never been back. Perhaps it wouldn't be the same the next time, but I'd like to try."
"Fine," said Walter, who, as usual, had appointed himself master of ceremonies. "Who's next?"
"I'll give you a quick answer," said Tanya Orlova. "The Bolshoi, Swan Lake. But Vasily won't agree. He hates ballet."
"That makes two of us. Anyway, what would you select, Vasily?"
"I was going to say diving, but Max beat me to it. So I'll go in the opposite direction. Gliding. Soaring through the clouds on a summer day in complete silence. Well, not quite complete. The airflow over the wing can get noisy, especially when you're banking. That's the way to enjoy Earth. Like a bird."
"Xenia?"
"Easy. Skiing in the Pamirs. I love snow."
"And you, Chandra?"
The atmosphere changed noticeably when Walter put the question. After all this time, Chandra was still a stranger, perfectly polite, even courteous, but never revealing himself.
"When I was a boy," he said slowly, "my grandfather took me on a pilgrimage to Varanasi, Benares. If you've never been there, I'm afraid you won't understand. To me, to many Indians, even nowadays, whatever their religion, it's the center of the world. One day I plan to go back."
"And you, Nikolai?"
"Well, we've had the sea and the sky. I'd like to combine both. My favorite sport used to be windsurfing. I'm afraid I'm too old for it now, but I'd like to find out."
"That only leaves you, Woody. What's your choice?"
Floyd did not even stop to think. His spontaneous answer surprised himself as much as the others.
"I don't mind where on Earth I am, as long as I'm with my little son."
After that, there was no more to be said. The session was over. Chapter 28, Frustration.
"You've seen all the technical reports, Dmitri, so you'll understand our frustration. We've learned nothing new from all our tests and measurements. Zagadka just sits there, filling half the sky, ignoring us completely. Yet it can't be inert, an abandoned space derelict. Vasily has pointed out that it must be taking some positive action to remain here at the unstable liberation point. Otherwise, it would have drifted away ages ago, just as Discovery did, and crashed into Io. So what do we do next? We wouldn't have nuclear explosives on board, would we, in contravention of UN08 Para 3? I'm only joking. Now that we're under less pressure, and the launch window for the homeward trip is still weeks away, there's a distinct feeling of boredom, as well as frustration. Don't laugh. I can imagine how that sounds to you back in Moscow. How could any intelligent person get bored out here, surrounded by the greatest marvels human eyes have ever seen? Yet there's no doubt of it. Morale isn't what it was. Until now, we've all been disgustingly healthy. Now almost everyone has a minor cold, or an upset stomach, or a scratch that won't heal, despite all of Katerina's pills and powders. She's given up now and just swears at us. Sasha has helped to keep us amused with a series of bulletins on the ship's bulletin board. Their theme is Stamp Out Rushlish, and he lists horrid mixtures of both languages he claims to have overheard, wrong uses of words, and so forth. We'll all need linguistic decontamination when we get home.
Several times I've come across your countrymen chatting in English without even being aware of it, lapsing into their native tongue only for difficult words. The other day I caught myself talking Russian to Walter Kernow, and neither of us noticed for several minutes. There was one bit of unscheduled activity the other day that will tell you something about our state of mind. The fire alarm went off in the middle of the night, triggered by one of the smoke detectors. Well, it turned out that Chandra had smuggled some of his lethal cigars aboard and couldn't resist temptation anymore. He was smoking one in the toilet like a guilty schoolboy. Of course, he was horribly embarrassed. Everyone else thought it hysterically funny after the initial panic. You know the way some perfectly trivial joke, which doesn't mean a thing to outsiders, can sweep through a group of otherwise intelligent people and reduce them to helpless laughter? One had only to pretend to light a cigar for the next few days, and everybody would go to pieces. What makes it even more ridiculous is that no one would have minded in the least if Chandra had just gone into an airlock or switched off the smoke detector. But he was too shy to admit that he had such a human weakness. So now he spends even more of his time communing with Hal. Floyd pressed the pause button and stopped the recording. Perhaps it was not fair to make fun of Chandra, tempting though it often was. All sorts of little quirks of personality had surfaced during the last few weeks. There had even been some bad quarrels, for no obvious reason. And for that matter, what of his own behavior? Had that always been above criticism? He was still not sure if he had handled Kernow properly, though he did not suppose that he would ever really like the big engineer, or enjoy the sound of his slightly too loud voice. Floyd's attitude toward him had changed from mere tolerance to respectful admiration. The Russians adored him, not least because his rendering of such favorites as Pulushko Polya often reduced them to tears, and in one case Floyd felt that the adoration had gone a little too far. "Walter," he had begun cautiously, "I'm not sure if it's my business, but there's a personal matter I'd like to raise with you." "When someone says it's not his business, he's usually right. What's the problem?" "To be blunt, your behavior with Max." There was a frigid silence, which Floyd occupied with a careful inspection of the poor paint job on the opposite wall. Then Kernow replied in a soft yet implacable voice, "I was under the distinct impression that he was more than 18. "Don't confuse the issue. And frankly, it's not Max I'm concerned about. It's Xenia." Kernow's lips parted in unconcealed surprise. "Xenia? What's she got to do with it?" "For an intelligent man, you're often singularly unobservant, even obtuse. Surely you realize that she's in love with Max. Haven't you noticed the way she looks when you put your arm around him?" Floyd had never imagined that he would see Kernow looking abashed, but the blow seemed to have struck home. "Xenia, I thought everyone was joking. She's such a quiet little mouse. And everyone's in love with Max, after their fashion, even Catherine the Great. Still, I guess I should be more careful, at least while Xenia's around." There was a prolonged silence while the social temperature rose back to normal. Then, obviously, to show that there was no ill feeling, Kernow added in a conversational tone, "You know, I've often wondered about Xenia. Somebody did a marvelous job of plastic surgery on her face, but they couldn't repair all the damage. The skin's too tight, and I don't think I've ever seen her laugh properly. Maybe that's why I've avoided looking at her. Would you credit me with so much aesthetic sensitivity, Haywood?" The deliberately formal Haywood signaled good-natured needling rather than hostility, and Floyd allowed himself to relax. "I can satisfy some of your curiosity." Washington finally got hold of the facts. "It seems she was in a bad air crash and was lucky to recover from her burns. There's no mystery, as far as we can tell, but Aeroflot isn't supposed to have accidents." "Poor girl. I'm surprised they let her go into space. But I suppose she was the only qualified person available when Irina eliminated herself." "I'm sorry for her. Apart from the injuries, the psychological shock must have been terrible." "I'm sure it was. But she's obviously made a full recovery." "You're not telling the whole truth," said Floyd to himself, "and you never will. After their encounter on the approach to Jupiter, there would always be a secret bond between them. Not of love, but of tenderness, which is often more enduring." He found himself suddenly and unexpectedly grateful to Kernow. The other was obviously surprised at his concern for Xenia, but had not attempted to exploit it in his own defense.
And if he had, would it have been unfair? Now, days later, Floyd was beginning to wonder if his own motives were altogether admirable. For his part, Curnow had certainly kept his promise. Indeed, if one did not know better, one might have imagined that he was deliberately ignoring Max, at least while Xenia was around, and he treated her with much greater kindness. Indeed, there were occasions when he had even succeeded in making her laugh out loud. So the intervention had been worthwhile, whatever the impulse behind it, even if, as Floyd sometimes ruefully suspected, it was no more than the secret envy that normal homo or heterosexuals feel, if completely honest with themselves, toward cheerfully well-adjusted polymorphs. His finger crept back toward the recorder, but the train of thought had been broken. Inevitably, images of his own home and family came crowding into his mind. He closed his eyes, and memory recalled the climax of Christopher's birthday party, the child blowing out the three candles on the cake, less than 24 hours ago, but almost a billion kilometers away. He'd played the video back so often that now he knew the scene by heart. And how often had Caroline played his messages to Chris, so that the boy would not forget his father, or view him as a stranger when he returned after missing yet another birthday? He was almost afraid to ask. Yet he could not blame Caroline. To him, only a few weeks would have passed before they met again. But she would have aged more than 2 years while he was in his dreamless sleep between the worlds. That was a long time to be a young widow, even a temporary one. I wonder if I'm coming down with one of the shipboard maladies, Floyd thought. He'd seldom felt such a sense of frustration, even of failure. I may have lost my family across the gulfs of time and space, all to no purpose, for I have achieved nothing. Even though I have reached my goal, it remains a blank, impenetrable wall of total darkness. And yet, David Bowman had once cried, "My God, it's full of stars!" Chapter 29, Emergence. Sasha's latest edict read, Rushlish Bulletin, Number 8. Subject, Tovarishcha. Tovarish. To our American guests. Frankly, pals, I can't remember when I was last addressed by this term. To any 21st century Russian, it's way back there with the battleship Potemkin. A reminder of cloth caps and red flags and Vladimir Ilyich haranguing the workers from the steps of railway carriages. Ever since I was a kid, it's been Bratyets or Drushkov. Take your choice. You're welcome. Comrade Kovalev. Floyd was still chuckling over this notice when Vasily Orlov joined him as he floated through the lounge observation deck on his way to the bridge. What amazes me, Tovarishcha, is that Sasha ever found time to study anything besides engineering physics. Yet he's always quoting poems and plays I don't even know, and he speaks better English than, well, Walter. Because he switched to science, Sasha is, what do you say, the black sheep of the family. His father was a professor of English at Novosibirsk. Russian was only allowed in the house Monday to Wednesday. Thursday to Saturday it was English. And Sundays? Oh, French or German, alternate weeks. Now I know exactly what you mean by nikuterni. Fits me like a glove. Does Sasha feel guilty about his defection? And with such a background, why did he ever become an engineer? At Novosibirsk, you soon learn who are the serfs and who are the aristocrats. Sasha was an ambitious young man, as well as a brilliant one. Just like you, Vasily. Et tu, Brute? You see, I can quote Shakespeare as well. Boshmoy! What was that? Floyd was unlucky. He was floating with his back to the observation window and saw nothing at all. When he twisted around seconds later, there was only the familiar view of Big Brother bisecting the giant disk of Jupiter, just as it had done ever since their arrival. But to Vasily, for a moment, that would be imprinted on his memory forever. That sharp-edged outline held a completely different and wholly impossible scene. It was as if a window had suddenly been opened onto another universe. The vision lasted for less than a second before his involuntary blink reflex cut it off. He was looking into a field, not of stars, but of suns, as if into the crowded heart of a galaxy or the core of a globular cluster. In that moment, Vasily Orlov lost forever the skies of Earth. From now on, they would seem intolerably empty,
Even mighty Orion and glorious Scorpio would be scarcely noticeable patterns of feeble sparks, not worthy of a second glance. When he dared to open his eyes again, it was all gone. No, not completely. At the very center of the now restored ebon rectangle, a faint star was still shining. But a star did not move as one watched. Orlov blinked again to clear his watering eyes. Yes, the movement was real. He was not imagining it. A meteor? It was some indication of Chief Scientist Vasily Orlov's state of shock that several seconds passed before he remembered that meteors were impossible in airless space. Then it blurred suddenly into a streak of light, and within a few heartbeats had vanished beyond the edge of Jupiter. By this time, Vasily had recovered his wits and was once more the cool, dispassionate observer. Already, he had a good estimate of the object's trajectory. There could be no doubt. It was aimed directly at Earth. Part 5. A Child of the Stars. Chapter 30. Homecoming. It was as if he had awakened from a dream, or a dream within a dream. The gate between the stars had brought him back to the world of men, but no longer as a man. How long had he been away? A whole lifetime? No, two lifetimes, one forward, one in reverse. As David Bowman, commander and last surviving crew member of United States Spaceship Discovery, he had been caught in a gigantic trap set 3 million years ago and triggered to respond only at the right time and to the right stimulus. He had fallen through it from one universe to another, meeting wonders, some of which he now understood, others which he might never comprehend. He had raced at ever-accelerating speed down infinite corridors of light until he had outraced light itself. That, he knew, was impossible, but now he also knew how it could be done. As Einstein had rightly said, the good Lord was subtle, but never malicious. He had passed through a cosmic switching system, a grand central station of the galaxies, and emerged protected from its fury by unknown forces, close to the surface of a giant red star. There he had witnessed the paradox of sunrise and the face of a sun when the dying star's brilliant white dwarf companion had climbed into its sky, a searing apparition drawing a tidal wave of fire beneath it. He'd felt no fear, but only wonder, even when his space pod had carried him down into the inferno below. To arrive, beyond all reason, in a beautifully appointed hotel suite containing nothing that was not wholly familiar. However much of it was fake, the books on the shelves were dummies, the cereal boxes and the cans of beer in the icebox, though they bore famous labels, all contained the same bland food with a texture like bread, but a taste that was almost anything he cared to imagine. He'd quickly realized that he was a specimen in a cosmic zoo, his cage carefully recreated from the images in old television programs, and he wondered when his keepers would appear and in what physical form. How foolish that expectation had been. He knew now that one might as well hope to see the wind or speculate about the true shape of fire. Then exhaustion of mind and body had overwhelmed him. For the last time, David Bowman slept. It was a strange sleep, for he was not wholly unconscious. Like a fog creeping through a forest, something invaded his mind. He sensed it only dimly, for the full impact would have destroyed him as swiftly and surely as the fires raging around him. Beneath its dispassionate scrutiny, he felt neither hope nor fear. Sometimes in that long sleep he dreamed he was awake. Years had gone by. Once he was looking in a mirror at a wrinkled face he barely recognized as his own. His body was racing to its dissolution, the hands of the biological clock spinning madly toward a midnight they would never reach. For at the last moment, time came to a halt and reversed itself. The springs of memory were being tapped. In controlled recollection, he was reliving the past, being drained of knowledge and experience as he swept back toward his childhood. But nothing was being lost. All that he had ever been, at every moment of his life, was being transferred to safer keeping. Even as one David Bowman ceased to exist, another became immortal, passing beyond the necessities of matter. He was an embryo god not yet ready to be born. For ages he floated in limbo, knowing what he had been, but not what he had become. He was still in a state of flux, somewhere between chrysalis and butterfly, or perhaps only between caterpillar and chrysalis. And then the stasis was broken. time re-entered his little world, the black rectangular slab that suddenly appeared before him was like an old friend. He had seen it on the moon. He had encountered it in orbit around Jupiter, and he knew, somehow, that his ancestors had met it long ago. Though it held still unfathomed secrets, it was no longer a total mystery. Some of its powers he now understood.